United States versus McLaughlin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Allenbaugh on behalf of Appellant John McLaughlin. Your Honors, this case involves, as the Court's well aware, the sentencing guidelines for child pornography. I'd like to address just four major points, two with procedural error and two regarding substantive error. With respect to procedural error, the district court made some errors of fact or findings of fact that were not supported by the record. The first was with respect to the market thesis. The market thesis is a common misconception regarding sentencing for child pornography offenders. The market thesis holds that the more onerous sentence a court imposes, the more likely it is to deter further conduct or to deter the production of child pornography. As we note in our brief, the market thesis actually has no basis in fact. The Sentencing Commission has recently produced a comprehensive report on federal child pornography offenses and addresses the market thesis specifically and notes that not only is there no data regarding the market thesis, but that it would be impossible to obtain any data or do any studies in that regard. The court below found that while there may not be 100% accuracy, I believe is what the terminology was, there is still some basic truth for it. And as this court has noted in Bradley, a defendant has a due process right to be sentenced on accurate information. This market thesis was wholly without foundation. Another related factual error that the district court made was with respect to the crossover thesis. The crossover thesis holds that a defendant who is convicted or found to possess trade with child pornography is a step away, to actually use the district court's terminology, from committing a contact offense. There is absolutely no support for that in the record. As a matter of fact, there was support for just the opposite. The appellant, the court below, introduced two expert reports indicating that he had a very low to no likelihood of engaging in any type of contact offense.
Well, there was testimony, however. What did the expert have to say about the testimony with regard to the fact that he was talking about child pornography, asking for advice from other people?
That was what the expert, I believe, termed fantasy chat. That's very often what happens in cases like this. The defendants will engage in some fantasy chat. But as the commission itself has recognized, Your Honor, in its report, this type of fantasy chat that occurs has little to no correlation between actual contact offenses. And again, in this particular case, with respect to this defendant, there was no evidence that he had either engaged in any prior contact offenses or was going to engage in any contact offenses in the future. There was also a small discussion or a short discussion during the sentencing hearing regarding production. And there, as we point out in our brief, the court seemed to be concerned about production. My client was not charged with production. There's no evidence that he produced any child pornography. It was just trading in child pornography. So there seemed to be at least some confusion on the part of the district court below with respect to what, in fact, my client had engaged in. Moving forward to the next area, procedural error, this is with respect to the fine. The court imposed a fine of $50,000 in this case without providing any reasoning whatsoever for the fine. And what was really interesting about this particular fine is the sentence that was imposed was a slight downward variance from the guideline range, whereas the fine was well within the guideline range as calculated by the probation office. The final guideline range was an offense level of 34.
Now, did counsel for your client ever object to the recommendation in the PSR that the court impose fine of $50,000?
Your Honor, I was counsel below. I did not object.
But then the review for that issue is plain error, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it could be plain error, but there, just for the record, it's not my reading of the PSR that there was a recommendation to impose any fine. There was just the note, as often is the case in pre-sentence investigation reports, what the fine range is. The guidelines provide a particular fine range dependent on the ultimate offense level. So there wasn't a recommendation per se. But nonetheless, even under a plain error review, I believe this constitutes...
And I also take it you didn't discuss that at sentencing, the amount of the fine.
No, the amount of fine came in at the very tail
right.
end, Your Honor.
I read the transcript, yep. But, I mean, you never raised that.
No,
you
that's
said,
correct,
you know,
Your Honor.
In addition to asking for a lower sentence, we're asking for a lesser fine.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Or a fine in X amount or no fine, given his financials or whatever.
That's correct. And finally, turning to substantive error, two related points that primarily center around the commission's report from February of 2013, the Federal Child Pornography Offenses Report that the commission spent the last few years putting together and compiling, looking at data, reviewing social science literature, as well as reviewing how courts have been sentencing by and large. And as we note in our brief, the commission has concluded that 2G2.2, which is the guideline that my client was sentenced under, is seriously outmoded. It warrants revision in view of its outdated and disproportionate enhancements. It produces overly severe sentencing ranges. And the commission concludes its 400-plus page report by asking Congress for permission, if you will, or for a directive to revise the entire guideline structure.
But here's our problem. We have a defendant who received a below-guideline sentence. There's been no final action to change the guideline. It's actually unclear if he would do better under any proposed changes. And to add to that, if there are changes, we don't know if they'll be retroactive. So our hands are tied in that regard.
Well, Your Honor, you raise a very, very good point. My position is that the guidelines as they stand right now have been disavowed. So regardless of what way we might speculate the commission might do in the future, the way the guidelines are right now, it says if any other agency, and the commission is just like an agency, has disavowed a particular regulation. It's as if the FDA...
They're statutory. It's the problem. The sentencing commission say whatever they want, but if they're statutory, there's nothing they can do about it without Congress. That's why they had to go to Congress.
Well, Your Honor, my reading of 28 U.S.C. 994 does allow the commission on its own authority to amend the guidelines. It has the statutory...
Well, certainly they can amend the guidelines, that's certain, but they can't amend the statute under which the... That's Congress to do that.
That's correct, Your Honor, and this would not require a statutory change, just a guideline change, and that's what the commission has asked Congress to do.
Yeah, but doesn't Congress have to sign off on the guidelines?
Not exactly. The way it works is the commission sends to Congress on May 1 of every year proposed amendments to the guidelines. If Congress does nothing, then by November 1, they become...
Congress has to do... Right.
Congress has to do nothing, as it were.
It can do nothing, yes.
And generally it does. However, the 700-plus amendments, it is only vetoed, I think, less than five.
If you're in an area in which Congress is very sensitive, which is why these statutory requirements are what? Child pornography is a hot-button issue, and if you have congressmen seem to be lowering the requirements for child pornography, they're in big trouble with the electorate.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I will just wrap up with this one point, though. Again, what the commission has done right now, that is what's material, that is what's germane. It has said these guidelines are no longer any good. The empirical foundation for them are no longer any good. Brady requires that, due process requires that a defendant be sentenced upon facts and articulated reasons, and here the Commission has said no to the 22G 2.2. And with that, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Best?
No, Ms. Best, sorry.
I'm being completely neutral this morning. Apparently, I can't tell the difference between man and woman.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Yasmin Best on behalf of the United States. And the District Court committed no error, procedural or substantive, when it sentenced the defendant to a sentence almost 2 years below the low end of the range and imposed a $50,000 fine.
Is there anything in the record that explains or justifies the amount of the fine? For example, why 50 instead of 25? Or I'm just looking for some evidence to anchor that particular number.
The District Court did explain precisely how it came to that number. The District Court did note that it adopted the PSR, which noted that the defendant had approximately $135,000 in assets. And before imposing sentence,
then it's mandatory that
if
the defendant can afford it.
Correct, Your Honor. And before imposing that fine, also inquired whether there was restitution at issue in this case. And because the offense of conviction didn't involve a request or a restitution demand, the court then imposed the $50,000 fine. And it's less than half of what the defendant had in his 401k and his other liquid assets at the time, and the District Court just pronounced the $50,000 fine, but did not go into significant detail at that point. In addition, the other theories that appellate counsel mentioned as being the basis for its argument that there was procedural error don't quite hold water here, because the District Court made clear that he was stepping away from the idea that the market thesis really supported a guideline range sentence. The District Court did say that it believed it had some viability, but I would note that the authorities that counsel relied on, both at sentencing and in his briefs, really deal with a different prong of the market thesis, which is essentially that children are not abused as a result of the existence of the marketplace. However, there is a distinction between the underlying abuse and then the creation of child pornography, which is the issue here. And the District Court did note that it believed that there was some validity to the idea that these images are created and shared in part because there is a market for them. Regarding the crossover theory, as counsel has named it.
Counsel, let me, these things are shared sometimes, but for example, would this defendant pay to receive some of these, whatever they get?
It's unclear whether the defendant ever actually paid monetarily for any of the images. The defendant, the record shows in this case, the defendant was an avid collector and had thousands upon thousands of these images and exchanged them with others and actually took part in a marketplace to share them, where he actively hid the nature of what he was sharing from the people who monitored the message boards on which he was distributing these, and went to separate rooms so that he could trade these images with others without detection. So there may be some trade between other people interested in child pornography for the point or for the purpose of receiving additional child pornography, but unclear whether he ever actually paid any money for it. But regarding this crossover theory, what was clear is that the District Court did not state that this defendant was mere moments away from committing a contact offense, but instead was one step removed in the hierarchy of people who commit these offenses. And that's clear. This defendant was interested in child pornography. And in terms of the conversations and the chats he had, he actually encouraged people to engage in the abuse of children. So while he was not engaged in it, and there's no evidence to believe that he was about to commit an offense, and there's no reason to believe that the District Court held that he was about to commit such an offense, there is evidence in the record that he was one step removed from the people who were committing these offenses, and I believe that's what the District Court...
There was some testimony that he thought about adopting Asian children or something?
That's correct, Your Honor. In the terms of the chat, the defendant talked about wishing he had access to children, wishing he could adopt children so that he could abuse them in similar ways. And that was part of his chat conversation when he was exchanging these messages. And to be clear, the District Court actually made clear on the record in sentencing that he did not believe the defendant was a producer of child pornography, and that was one of the reasons supporting the below-guideline sentence that the district court imposed. The sentencing transcript, I believe at page 23, the court said that there is a certain consideration that has to be given to the fact that this defendant is not a producer of the pornographic image. So the district court didn't confuse this defendant with a producer of these types of images. All that to say that when the defendant argues that there is a substantively unreasonable sentence here, it bears noting again that the court sentenced the defendant to a below-guideline sentence. And it did so because it understood that that the guideline ranges were perhaps too high and therefore wanted to sentence the defendant to what it felt was an appropriate sentence below the low end of the range.
And then in the PSI, getting back to this fine just one more time, the PSR rather indicated that the fine range was between $17,000 and $175,000 without making a specific recommendation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time. If there are no further questions, the government would ask that the court affirm the defendant's sentence.
Thank you. Counsel. Mr. Allenrew. How much time? You have 1 minute, Mr. Allenrew.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just address the below-guideline sentence. It's worth noting, as we do note in our brief, that the percentage decrease or the percentage downward variance was only 14% for my client. The average, and this is using 2012 sentencing data, the average downward decrease for those sentenced under 2G2.2, where they've received a downward variance, is 41.4%. So this not only indicates that, you know, my client's decrease certainly isn't anything of any significance, but also contributes, 2G2.2, as this court mentioned in Holiday, contributes to the unwarranted sentencing disparity that the commission is so cognizant of and addresses in its report. And with that, Your Honors, I would ask that this court vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing in order that the district court may consider the federal child pornography sentencing report. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel.
I just want to say how very well briefed both of this case was, and thank both of you.
I reiterate it too. It was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next case.